I'm John Kroll. Today on No Limits, we're going to look at one of the more disturbing episodes in Indianapolis's past. February marks the 40th anniversary of the time Tony Caritsas took mortgage broker Richard Hall hostage for 63 hours and made the Circle City the focus of horrified national attention. A new documentary explores the episode. My guests are the documentary's producers, Alan Berry and Mark Enox, as well as longtime Indianapolis anchor Tom Cochran and TV videographer Jack Parker. Please join the conversation. Call 866-476-3881. Email is nolimitswfyi.org. Facebook is nolimitswfyi. Twitter is WFYI. Now, this news. Welcome to No Limits. I'm John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of the StatehouseFile.com, and your host. 40 years ago this month, Tony Caritsas walked into his mortgage broker's office in downtown Indianapolis carrying a flower box under his arm. Moments later, Caritsas paraded the man, Richard Hall, out of the building, holding a sawed-off shotgun wired to his neck. For the next 3 days, the hostage incident played out on live radio and TV broadcasts, riveting audiences across the country. Here's what listeners to 1070 WIBC were hearing on the morning of February 8th, 1977.
Mark, you've been following another aspect of this hostage situation. What can you report to us at this time?
Well, Tom, right now the suspect and his victim are proceeding westbound on Washington Street in an Indianapolis police car with red lights flashing. The car is number 2-132. It was proceeding west on demand from the kidnapper, apparently, as a consequence and part of the hostage situation that developed about an hour ago. The victim has been identified to us tentatively by a co-employee as a Dick Hall, who apparently owns a real estate or some land office here in downtown Indianapolis. The hostage situation developed at Market Street in Pennsylvania. It was first reported as a man holding a gun to the head of at least two Indianapolis police officers. It turned out that it was, by the time we got there at least, a situation where the suspect, who has been identified to us so far as a Tony, who apparently did some business with Dick Hall, had a shotgun, a sawed-off shotgun perhaps, wired and tied to the neck of Dick Hall and was holding the man hostage at that point. There was a procession as the victim and his kidnapper were proceeding westbound on Washington Street for approximately 10 to 15 minutes. At the intersection of Senate and Washington Street, a vacant police car, red lights flashing, was parked. The kidnapper and his hostage got into the car, the hostage driving, the kidnapper holding the gun to his head, and they proceeded west on Washington Street, getting away from police momentarily. He had been surrounded by police on foot for the entire distance of the procession. So that's the status at this point, Tom. The last we saw, a barrage of police cars was following car number 2-132 down West Washington Street.
Now, are these unmarked units or are these marked police units?
No, this is a marked police unit complete with the Visibar and the whole bit. The red lights were flashing and it is our standard marked Indianapolis police car.
And to elaborate on what you said earlier, there is not an Indianapolis police officer in the hostage car.
No, there is not a policeman in the car. It is strictly the kidnapper and his hostage in the vehicle with the hostage driving the car at last we saw.
That was from a live radio broadcast from February 8th, 1977 on 1070 WIBC. Local media picked up the Caritsas story early and stayed with it. And among our guests today are two broadcasters who were there as the Caritsas kidnapping unfolded. Joining us by Skype today are Tom Cochran, a longtime Indianapolis reporter and anchorman, and Jack Parker, a veteran television videographer in Indianapolis. Also joining us are Alan Berry and Mark Enox, who are producing a documentary about the case. They're hoping to premiere it at the 2017 Heartland Film Festival. Welcome to all of you.
Thank you.
Good morning.
It's good to have you here. So I'm going to start, Tom, because obviously there was a familiar voice on that broadcast. There are people who are likely listening to this broadcast. The Caritsas episode was something that those of us who grew up in the city and have lived here for a long time, it's seared into our memories. But a lot of the people who are listening right now either were born after that happened or have moved here since then. Could you, in a thumbnail, talk about exactly what happened there?
We had never seen anything like it before. Just those scenes
that Allen shows, excuse me, in his documentary. I think people who were not alive, excuse me, who had not seen this event as it occurred, will be absolutely fascinated and riveted by the scene of a man holding a shotgun to the head of another man while they are surrounded by a handful of police officers, some of them with their weapons drawn. And they're walking in shirt sleeves on a very cold February day down the streets of Indianapolis. And that was just the beginning of what was 3 days of sort of an indelible imprint in people's mind. Tony took Dick Hall to the Crestwood Village Apartments on the west side, said he had wired an apartment with explosives. This is where he held Hall as police and eventually an FBI coordinator and other law enforcement, Marion County Sheriff's deputies, as well as a whole phalanx of media from across the state and eventually around the world encamped at the Crestwood Village. And this drama played out. And it played out in a kind of loop because Tony Caritzis, we know, was listening to the radio and watching television. And so we were feeding to a larger audience, the general public, but we were also feeding to a very critical audience, that of Tony Caritzis and Dick Hall. A man's life was in the balance while this sort of extraordinary event, which to that point had been without precedent, was occurring.
So, Alan, what drew you to this story at this time?
So Mark and I have made a couple different documentaries, and we had just done a documentary with Mayor Ballard. We followed him the day in the life of what he does, and we were looking at options as far as what should our next documentary be. Mark and I came up with a list of ideas. We let family members and friends look at it and kind of rate them. Mark had the idea of this Tony Caritzis story, and it by far won. You know, everybody said, do this story.
Mm-hmm. And Mark, I think that's your cue, Mark.
And we started to reach out. And what was really important, first of all, was just finding somebody who was involved in it that would talk with us. And almost right away, we got connected with Jack Parker, who was a cameraman for WTTV at the time. And was there on the street. And he immediately shared his footage with us, let us interview him. And from there, we started to branch out. We've now done 39 interviews with people who were involved over a period of about 4 years.
Over four.
So, yeah, we've gone the whole way.
But what drew you to it? Why did you bring up that idea?
Why was that one?
I was in the second grade when this happened. Okay. And I don't recall it happening in February, but in the summer, there was a lot of grand jury testimony before Tony actually went to trial. And so the local TV stations, they showed this constantly during the news breaks at noon. And there was nothing else for us to watch back then. So when the news came on, I would watch it. And this image of this man jerking this other guy around with a shotgun, it was just, I couldn't believe it. I thought it was a national piece. And then realizing slowly, no, this happened here. And that's just stuck with me forever, those images.
Jack, I think we heard a cue for you, too. At what point did you begin covering the story? How did you first hear about it?
I was at WTTV Studios on South Bluff Road. Mm-hmm. And I guess, in a way, it helped me as far as my angle of coverage, because I rolled in from the south side and parked my car at the corner of Meridian and Washington Street. Now, this had been going on for about a half hour, and we were alerted to it via the radio traffic that there was a man holding a man with a gun, then a man holding a gun to a police officer, and I was out the door with, at that time, our newsroom secretary, who evolved into a reporter on that day. But we rolled in there, and I jumped out and grabbed my film camera and ran around the corner. And by that time, Tony and Dick had stopped in front of Richmond Brothers, which was about mid-block between Pennsylvania and Meridian Street. And I kind of made my way alongside the building. And my first thought when I came around the corner was, this is like OK Corral high noon. There was no traffic on the street. There were just these two guys across the street up a little ways, and then there was a cluster of people back at Pennsylvania and Washington Street. And so I made my way up to where I was even with them, and then slowly kind of worked my way out to and used the light pole so I could steady my camera up shooting across the street. And they were probably there, it seemed like 5 minutes or so. My first impression was, I can't believe what I'm seeing in my viewfinder. This was like a scene out of Kojak, which was a very popular TV series with Telly Savalas at the time.
Who loves you, baby.
And they were there like 5 minutes or so. And then Tony yelled back toward the crowd, which I didn't realize at the time, was there were some police officers. And that's where the rest of the media who would come down from North Meridian Street to cover this. And then about that time, there was just an entourage of a couple police cars came by. And as they started their walk down toward Meridian Street, I kind of moved out to the middle of the street. And by the time we passed Meridian Street, I basically was shooting over the police car to them on the sidewalk. So I was probably within about 30 feet of them. And carried them all the way down to Senate Street, where they commandeered the police car, and then rode off into the west side.
If you're just joining us, we are talking about the 40th anniversary of the Caritas hostage taking. There's a new documentary that's going to be coming out on it. If you want to join the conversation, please give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. You can send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. Find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi or on Twitter at wfyi. Tom, part of what made this so riveting is that there was an almost surreal quality to it while it was unfolding, in that, and I'm assuming the documentary is going to capture some of this, that Tony Caritas knew some of the police officers by name. He was almost, you know, asking for them as if one would ask for, you know, a favorite waiter at a restaurant or something like that. He developed relationships with some of the journalists who were covering him, and their conversations were frank and almost intimate. What were your memories of that? Because you were part of that process.
I had been at the studio when the event started to occur. Mark Watkins and Doug O'Brien were in the downtown area, and they followed the initial event there on Washington Street as they headed west in Indianapolis. I was then dispatched to the Crestwood Village apartment, where I spent the better part of the next 3 days. There was a familiarity between Tony and a number of the law enforcement officers, both IPD and the Marion County Sheriff's Department. So this was almost like an extended family feud, with the additional lethality of a man having his head wired to a shotgun. And the time Tony had said he had his apartment wired with explosives, so we knew there was a particular danger involved. That here was a man who felt as though he had been done wrong and he was seeking his own brand of justice. And yet both Hall and Caritas were known to people in law enforcement and in the media. We sort of crossed a Rubicon in journalism and public access to these kind of events in this Caritas affair, John. We had never seen this kind of event played out, where there was this extended live coverage both on radio and television, and where, in essence, Tony Caritas was given access to the media to air his grievances. It was part of a negotiation strategy. It was a way they thought of sort of defusing his anger. If he is able to vent and let people know what his issues were, that it might help moderate an eventual resolution of this. But in doing that, we cross this line of, do you give a man who, if he is not mad, is certainly upset and angry, in that sense mad, access to the airwaves, completely unedited. Fred Heckman and he had a series of telephone conversations. Words that had never been broadcast previously were broadcast because
the
nature of Tony's language. At the same time, there was no way to filter this. There was really no way to sort of put a damper down on Tony using the media as his own pulpit. And at the same time, as I alluded to earlier, he's listening to everything that is being broadcast, watching everything that's being broadcast and responding to it. I think it was in the second day of the siege, Doug O'Brien was doing a report about if the SWAT team were to move, if this is the sort of way that they would proceed. Karitsis, in his fatigue and anger, sort of misunderstood what he was hearing and thought that a siege was underway, and he began to yell and explode, and there were people on the other side of the door that he'd been negotiating with and talking to, and he said, "Get out of here, I'm going to do it." They thought maybe explosives. They thought perhaps he was going to shoot at Dick Hall.
Tom,
family and law enforcement.
Tom,
yes.
I'm going to have to jump in. We got to take a break here. We're talking about the 40th anniversary of the Tony Karitsis hostage taking here on No Limits today. I am John Kroll. You're listening to No Limits. Please stay with us. Welcome back to No Limits. I am John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of the StateHouseFile.com, and your host. We're talking today about the 40th anniversary of the time that Tony Karitsis took Richard Hall hostage here in downtown Indianapolis and held him for 63 hours while microphones, TV cameras, still cameras and print reporters were recording just about every movement and move. There's a new documentary coming out that will tell the story of this episode. My guests are the documentary's producers, Alan Berry and Mark Enochs. They're in studio with me, and longtime Indianapolis reporter and anchorman Tom Cochran and news photographer Jack Parker via Skype. Tom, before we went to the break, I cut you off mid-story there,
That's
so I
okay.
want to give you a chance to wrap up. But if I could, I could redirect because, you know, that the Karitsis episode was in a lot of journalism ethics textbooks for quite a while. There was a lot of soul-searching that went on after that. And I know from talking to one of your longtime colleagues here in the market, Mike Ahern, he says he keeps asking himself the question whether they even should have been there in the first place. Could you talk a little bit about that, about the kinds of decisions you had to make on the fly about what was going to go on the air and what wasn't?
That was it's a very good question. And I think people who were involved with that, you know, continue, as Mike does, to ruminate about it and think, should we have, you know, done this? Should we have given Tony access? Should we have turned this into the kind of media circus that it was? But it was the first time. And so we were feeling our way along and sort of making up the rules, if you will, as we went along. The problem was that Tony, we thought, was probably unstable. And a way to moderate his behavior was to by the behavioral control expert who came out from Quantico, Virginia, an FBI man who was very good and was sort of the mastermind a lot of the negotiation, thought, as long as Tony can vent, that's a way of sort of controlling his mood. Well, that is a calculated decision made by someone in a hostage situation to keep somebody alive. Those of us who were journalists had a different sort of set of rules that we were playing by. And it came to a head in our specific situation, John, when Fred Heckman, our news director, who was also our morning news anchor at the time, became directly involved in the conversations with Tony and with the behavioral control expert. Fred became a willing participant in the attempt to keep Dick Hall alive. So it was a noble purpose, but at the same time, he had crossed the Rubicon on being a journalist or being involved. A group of us who were staff from WIBC gathered one afternoon in a kind of rump caucus, and we decided, you know, Fred cannot be entirely forthcoming even with his own staff about what he knows and what the plans are, and yet he's on the air. We need to tell him he has to remove himself from the coverage. This is our boss that we're talking mm-hmm. about. I drew the short straw, and so I called Fred, and Fred said, "Well, I think you're wrong." And I said, "Well, Fred, you know, there is a difference of opinion here, but we just think you should not be involved." And I said, "Can you tell us everything you know?" And he said, "Well, no." And I said, "Well, that ought to tell you alone in your own mind that you shouldn't be involved." Fred eventually conceded, and he stepped out of the coverage and became sort of a negotiator, if you will. Fred and I did some panel discussions and seminars mm-hmm. for a couple of years after this event, where we continued to revisit that particular moment where we decided he is no longer engaged as a journalist. He's now a part of the story, and we have to sort of winnow that out. Hard decision to make, but I think ultimately in the long run, it was the right thing by a set of ethics. But again, back to your point, this was all brand new. Nobody had been down this road before. So as we were going along, we were really operating in a kind of blindness.
Well, and there was a not so implied threat that if the microphones and the cameras didn't show up, Tony was just going to kill Hall, too.
Right.
So, you know, it was kind of the, I'll clean it up in reverse homage, I guess, to Tony Caritsis and say, a darned if you do and darned if you don't kind of situation. Jack, well, you were there because you were right there with a camera trying to catch as much of this as you could. Did you have any qualms about what you were recording? Did you think, oh, maybe I ought to put the camera down? Or was it just, there's a story here and, you know, my job's tell the story?
I can't say that I had any qualms. I was caught up at the moment. My job was to record it. And keep in mind, this was with film. Yeah. So I only had 11 and a half minutes of film before I had to change out. I might miss something. And that actually happened to a couple of other guys in the media. That's why my film wound up being Exhibit A in a trial. I probably had the best angle until they departed in the police car, obviously. But no, I never had any qualms about what I was shooting. It was just trying to judge how much I was shooting, watching my exposure. You know, this was back before there was auto iris. you had to eyeball it. I think, you know, once they were gone and things calmed down, of course, we were involved in the chase out to the west side then.
Yeah.
I think it all started to come home saying, wow, I can't believe I just recorded something like that. So it's, you know, and you were talking about earlier about, you know, Dick Hall and Tony. Mm-hmm. At one point, my thought was, he's going to kill him right here on the street.
Yeah.
And that's at Illinois and Washington Street. Somebody had said something. I could not really hear a whole the interplay, but there was interplay all the way down the street. And at Illinois and Washington Street, somebody said something, and Tony stopped and started to turn around, and he kind of jerked Dick Hall around like a dog on the end of the leash. And there was some ice there on the sidewalk. And they both slipped, and they both went down. I thought if the gun was going to go off, it should have gone off then.
Yeah.
Fortunately, it didn't. And one of the sounds that you can hear, there was a young officer with a more experienced officer between me and Tony. And you can hear the conversation of them saying, you know, he was trying to pull his gun to shoot him right then. And the older officer was saying, no, you know, leave it in the holster. Leave it. Just, you know, put it away. So, you know, there was a lot of second guessing from the police department after that on how we should have handled all this. And as far as I know, this film is still being used at Quantico by the FBI because I occasionally get calls about it. So it's a unique part of Indianapolis and Indianapolis news history.
We are talking about the 40th anniversary of the time Tony Caritsis took Richard Hall hostage for 63 hours. If you would like to join the conversation, you can send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. Find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi, on Twitter at wfyi. Or you can do what a listener named Ann has done and give us a call at 866-476-3881. Ann, welcome to the program.
Hi, thank you. I had a couple of questions. One, I wanted, as slightly been addressed already, I was curious about mental illness and its role in this. And the other related to this, you're talking about airing this on television.
And I was curious. And you're cutting out on us a bit.
When the terrorists took the Israelis wrestling team and when the timing of that was, because to me, that was kind of the barrier that was broken in terms of showing a violent event on television. I remember watching that, but I don't remember when it happened relative to this event.
Oh, you're talking about the Israelis at the Olympics? That was 1972. Yeah, but you're breaking up on us a bit, so thank you for the call. Appreciate it, and the questions.
Sorry. Thank you.
Certainly. Thank you. So, Mark.
Yeah, the Munich Olympics 72, there mm-hmm. was a lot of people taken hostage and people were killed there. And some of that was shown. None of it was covered like this was, mm-hmm. Where you have multiple TV stations and an extraordinary number of uniformed police officers and detectives involved following. She also talked about mental health. Mental health becomes a bigger issue when it moves to the trial.
Mm-hmm.
The defense was seeking a not guilty by reason of insanity. The prosecution was seeking a guilty verdict. And at that time, the burden of proof was on them, on the prosecution. Mm-hmm. They had to prove that Tony was sane to get that guilty verdict. Now, that made it very easy for the defense because all they had to do was roll all this footage that they had and say, does that guy look like he's sane?
Mm-hmm.
Tony was also evaluated by a lot of psychologists, too, and they all came up with varying diagnoses. But most of them said, yeah, he's got some issues, dissociation, all this stuff. A couple said, no, he knows what he's doing. So it was a toss-up amongst some of the professionals there, too, about whether or not he was suffering from a real live mental illness.
But to be fair, the professionals were from each side of the courtroom, right? So the prosecutors,
prosecution and defense were picking their own experts, is it?
Correct.
As it were. Well, and like a lot of media figures in this city, I remember when I was a newspaper reporter for the Indianapolis News, Tony Caritsis would call me. Maybe 3 or 4 times a year. And Tom, did you continue to have any contact with Tony after all of this?
Yes. Yeah. Tony, I was also one of the people that received telephone calls and sometimes mail. And while he was incarcerated, while he was in the custody of the state and then later, it became a little bit of an irritation to take another call from him.
Oh, yeah.
Which is not necessarily, I think, a callous thing. It's just that was the nature of Tony and his grievance. I think our understanding in the media about mental health issues and even the sort of the very intrinsic arguments in court were probably less sophisticated then than they are now. The access you mentioned, Alan and Mark mentioned that the access of the media to this story was also something without precedent. So you have this drama occurring in what was a very competitive environment in those days. Newspapers, radio stations, wire services, newspapers from out of town, as well as television stations and networks and radio stations all competing to get sort of their own take on this. And that just seemed to amplify it. What Alan and Mark have done is taken on a project that has a lot of sort of precedent-setting moments in it. But in watching, I had a chance last night to view a 13-minute rough cut mm-hmm. of sort of the opening of the program, Jack's footage, and I think maybe there might have been some footage from Bill Fisher.
Yes.
As well. But it is absolutely extraordinary. It is probably as riveting as anything that you would see in a Catherine Bigelow film. She did Zero mm-hmm. Dark Thirty and others. Because this is real, and you see this occurring. And as Jack mentioned earlier, when they slipped and fell on the ice, and you know, I had forgotten that occurred mm-hmm. until I saw it last night, because I was not downtown to see that. I had seen it later in news coverage. But when that slip and fall occurred, it just sort of brought my heart into my throat all of these years later. And this is playing out as it happened. It's Jack had extraordinary vantage point, and what you see is remarkable, if only for the history of it, let alone the sort of the life and death drama of it. So I really applaud Alan and Mark in doing the extensive work they've done to sort of mine all of the sort of the nuances of this story.
Well, one of the things I noticed, I saw the 13-minute preview. As well, that I did not notice when this drama unfolded while I was in high school. And I remember watching it live because even then I was kind of a news nerd. But was the fact that, you know, you're seeing these two guys, but you're also seeing all of these people who are working in offices and working in downtown Indianapolis who are looking out at it and trying to figure out, okay, what is going on here? You said you've done 39 interviews already. Have you managed to track any of those folks down who were actual eyewitnesses to it, who weren't there as part of the media?
No, we haven't. Part of the issue with that would be who are these nameless people?
Yeah.
Finding who the videographer was or the photographer, you can look through old newspapers and figure that out.
And unfortunately, some of them have passed on to who were involved, store owners along Washington there.
Yeah.
Right. Matter of fact, a few of the people we've interviewed have already passed on. So it's one of those things where we started to understand that we really need to start, you know, pushing, getting people before some of them pass. Mm-hmm. And
but yeah, it was remarkable. Nobody knew what to do. Some police went ahead and said, "Get back inside your storefronts, lock the doors, just don't come out." And yet people still were pressed up against the windows as the parade passed by. I don't think a lot of people even understood how dangerous that situation was.
At the very beginning, there was people waving to the cameraman because they don't know what's going on. And it's in their same building that this Dick Hall's being kidnapped. And so they were just kind of clueless to what was going on. How would they know?
Well, and one of the things that we probably ought to ask, Richard Hall is still alive and, in fact, has a book coming out about this ordeal. Was he able to talk to you?
So we a long time ago, of course, Richard Hall was the person that we wanted to get on camera and talk to. We did a lot of research. We thought that he was dead for some time because there was a Richard O. Hall that had an obituary. So we kind of were about the similar age. I contacted his ex-wife and she said that I should be talking to Richard Hall. So I was like, oh, he's alive? And she said, yeah. We ended up going to – I tried to contact him, couldn't get a hold of him, went to his house, spoke to his son. It seemed like there was no interest to be a part of this, so we dropped it.
Probably not happy memories for him.
Right. Yeah. And why would you want to pursue that? I mean, the man had been through a lot. I didn't want to press the point there with him. If he wanted to be involved, that would be great. And apparently – he does have a story to tell, and he does feel that now is the time to do that after talking with his children.
So we have been in contact with his book people, and there looks like there may be a chance of us interviewing him in April when he comes back to promote his book.
And we probably ought to emphasize also that Tony Caritsis has been dead for more than a decade.
He died in 2005.
Yeah, so it's you're not able to talk with him, but he wasn't exactly shy about talking to the media. You got a lot of video.
We did talk to his brother Jimmy. And we talked to some other related people. I think we have a good understanding, somewhat good understanding of Tony. I would have rather interview him as well, but just via all the other interviews, you do get a better picture of him. And he's not just a crazed lunatic. He was a good guy too to a lot of people. He was a somewhat of a family man in the way of loyalty. If you were loyal to him, he was definitely loyal to you. So I don't think everybody has this perspective that Tony was a lunatic, because to a lot of people he was a good friend.
Well, and one of the things, go ahead, Tom. Yeah, we got about 30 seconds, Tom.
Yeah. Tony seemed like he could be a very nice guy. But when he was dealing with those of us in the media, he generally still had this beef, this gripe, these issues. And he was very pointed, and he was somewhat closed-minded on the ability to sort of be rational with you about that. I don't mean he became outrageous, but he was just pretty locked in his own mind what was right and what was wrong.
We are talking today about the 40th anniversary of the time that Tony Caritsis took mortgage broker Richard Hall hostage and held him for 63 hours. While the nation, the world, and Indianapolis watched. My guests are producers of a documentary about the episode, Alan Berry and Mark Enochs, and two people who covered it, longtime Indianapolis reporter and anchorman Tom Cochran, and news photographer, videographer Jack Parker. I am John Kroll. You're listening to No Limits. Please stay with us. Welcome back to No Limits. I am John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of the StatehouseFile.com, and your host. We're talking today about the 40th anniversary of the time that Tony Caritsis took mortgage broker Richard Hall hostage and held him for 63 hours while Indianapolis was riveted and then eventually the nation and the world. That episode, that disturbing episode in Indiana's history, is the subject of a new documentary, Dead Man's Line, that will be premiering, hopefully, at the Heartland Film Festival this year. Talking with me today are the producers, Alan Berry and Mark Enochs. They're in studio, and joining us by Skype, our longtime Indianapolis reporter and anchorman, Tom Cochran, and videographer Jack Parker. Both Tom and Jack covered the Kuritsis story. I don't think people have quite gotten a sense of how heightened everything was of this. Get a little more audio from it that I think I'd like to play. This is actually, you're going to hear Tony Kuritsis' voice here, and I will caution those people who remember this episode, it is the G-rated version of Tony Kuritsis. There aren't F-bombs and all of that stuff being dropped here.
Please forgive me for the language that I use. I've been an angry man for 44 years. Nobody has had the adversity that I've had. But in spite of that, and without arrogance and without putting my friends down or the general population down and without being egotistical, I am the strongest man mentally that I know, the soundest man that I've ever met. And you can ask a lot of people that I know whether that's true or not. The average guy that would have gone through this would have already had a heart attack and or a stroke. These guys are lucky they're dealing with me, because some nervous Norman would have already shot them. Now I'll tell you what these people tried to do, sir. It's almost indescribable. To the average man, he will be unable to comprehend it. You may not, but people in this business know. These people betrayed, they set me up, they schemed to ruin a life, a human life, my life. You've got 100 armed officers around here trying to get a shot at me. They had a couple hundred down on the street yesterday morning. I dared them to shoot me. I didn't go down there to be a buffoon. I went down there for vengeance. And by God, I'll have vengeance.
That was Tony Kuritsis from a disturbing episode that unfolded here in downtown Indianapolis 40 years ago in 1977 that is the subject of a new documentary, Dead Man's Line. And it's tragic because as I'm listening to that, we were talking about the fact that a lot of us who were in media circles got calls from Tony, and I remember the pattern was always the same. The first couple of minutes of the conversation, he sounded fairly balanced and rational. And then about 3 minutes into the conversation, he would drop the first F-bomb. And then after that, he used them pretty much as punctuation. I mean, commas, periods, whatever, to do kind of a riff on George Carlin. But he was, and I'm going to ask kind of a, because all of you are intimately involved in this, he was an angry, angry man. Tell me, start with you. Did you ever get a sense of what made him so angry?
Well, he had a sense of right and wrong, and he felt as though that he had really been worked over by corporate types. In sort of reconstructing his personality, as we all tried to do it at the time, and as we moved into the trial and the sort of the mental health hearing phase. He was a man with passion. He was a man with sort of a quick temper, but he is a man who thought if he was wrong, he was going to try and seek right. I told him in one conversation that I said, you know, Tony, you're like a dog with a bone. And he responded in language I cannot use here. You're blankety blank right. I'm a dog with a bone, and I'm going to hang on to this bone. I'm going to jam it someplace. And I think that was right. He had this issue that was unresolved. And so he did live with anger. It continued to fester in his life.
Jack, while you were shooting him, not in the video sense here, I guess, yeah. I should clarify. And watching one of the things that, you know, in watching the preview, and a lot of it is your footage, which is interesting, is that Tony Caritsas's rage just literally seems to seep through the camera there. I mean, you can feel his anger, even though in some places there isn't a lot of sound or anything like that. But you can tell this is a really angry guy. You know, what was your response while you were recording this going down? Were you thinking, okay, trying to figure out what this guy's story was or what the source of his rage might be?
No, I don't think I got that in really into his psyche, but I can just tell by his movements, what words I could hear on the street, that yes, he was a very violent man who definitely had had lost control. Yet he seemed to have some control, and there were a couple different points where he would stop and would, you know, shout at the police officers, and he kept saying, you know, some of the police officers are my best friends. I like police officers. And so it would go like from one side of the aisle to the other where he hated police officers, and then he yelled at him, he says, just do your job. So it was almost like he was inciting them to take him out or try to take him out, yet he didn't want to be taken out. But there was one key point at the end of the walk down Washington Street where there was a break, and that was as we got to Illinois or Washington and Senate ran all the way through at that point. Police officer had gotten out of his car to block traffic, had left his car door open, and it was just 10 or 15 feet north of the crosswalk. I followed him, and he's going down there toward the car. All of a sudden, there was a screech of tires, and at that instant, you could see the tension just escape from his face. Mm-hmm. He's like, what's going on? I spun around and got a car going the other way that got caught up in a moment, rebounding off a light pole. The guy was wasn't watching what he was supposed to be doing. He rebounded off the light pole. And then I turned back around, and that's where you see he's basically in the driver's seat, and he's pulling Dick Hall in with him. But that may have saved something at that point because there was actually a break in the tension, thanks to the errant motorist on the other side.
What's the anger? I'm going to throw this to Alan Mark as well. I mean, in your research here, my experience with him was his anger wasn't just confined to Richard Hall and that situation. I mean, he would call me and rail about Rush Limbaugh or Bill Clinton. He seemed to be nonpartisan or bipartisan. He hated everybody. But do you get out of the research and the interviewing where his sense of anger came from?
I mean, I think it goes back quite a ways. He had his father was a pretty hard guy, not a touchy feely guy. Pretty, you know, very. He punished him for things. They ran an ice cream store, and there were many times Tony had to push his ice cream cart through these neighborhoods when he didn't want to. And all his friends who were at high school, they were all sitting there watching. It was sort of humiliating to him. And then when Tony's mother dies, that's when he really starts to change. He never got along well with his father after that. And after that, there are a series of ramping up incidents. He ran a trailer park for his family, and there are multiple times there where he went a little too far. He fired a weapon at his brother. He took an axe and tried to run off a utility workers who were there to do line work. It just kept escalating, and then it finally stopped when he demanded to be paid for managing the trailer park from his family. The family owned it, and they didn't want to pay him at first. So he went into his sister's house, and she was the one who owned it, and he held her hostage in her room. She shut her door. He was outside of it, but he had a gun, and he said, I'm not going away till you give me my money. He was arrested. The family did not press charges, so that was dropped. He had no record, and then they paid him $55,000. He takes that money and he buys the land with that. Now he wants to develop it and he needs more money for that. And that's why he goes to Meridian Mortgage. And as that development project doesn't come together, M.L. Hall, who is Dick's father, the main guy he dealt with, their relationship just got more and more confrontational. There's at least one occasion when M.L. Hall has to physically manhandle Tony out of a room where he's yelling about the finances that they're discussing. So all of this is building. And from Tony's perspective, the land is his last, like, treasure chest. It's his last chance. If it falls through and he can't pay back that loan, he's out the land because they'll foreclose on it, and he's got no other prospects. Up to that time, he was working here and there as a used car salesman for a few months at a time. So Tony was the epitome of desperation.
I can't say much more than what Mark said. That's pretty much how we feel his anger has come from. But I think that it does go back to the fact that Tony's a loyal type person. But if you break that loyalty, then he's all vengeance. And M.L. Hall was a father figure to him. So when he felt M.L. Hall was screwing him over, he felt that loyalty was broken, and he unleashed his rage on Dick because Dick happened to be there, and M.L. Hall was in Florida on vacation. So Tony never intended to take Richard Hall. His whole intent was to take the father, M.L. Hall.
Who was not there at that time. We've talked about this a little bit already. But we ought to talk some more about the fact that because this was such a cause celeb, everybody was paying attention to it. It did change the way news coverage was conducted. I'm going to give Tom the first word on this, but I want to hear the documentarian's views, too.
Tom? It did. There were the issues of, what do we cover? How do we cover it? Do we give him access to the airwaves? One of the television stations and WIBC radio did that. Probably this all came to, if you will, maybe a focus in that last evening after the negotiations had sort of broken down a couple of times. He was supposed to release Dick Hall and then come into the little foyer of one of the buildings where the operations center had been set up and surrender. Well, he didn't do that, and he walked Dick Hall across the courtyard, still wired, and that was not supposed to be the case. And then he walked into this lobby of one of the buildings there at the Crestwood Village, and he faces a phalanx of cameras and bright lights and media, and there are law enforcement personnel. And those moments of him holding forth on live television and radio with a gun at the back of Dick Hall's head pointed towards the cameras. If he went from absolute rage a look of anger and hatred in his face to where he was crying. And he was laughing, and he was calling out to people that he knew, and you know me, you know what I'm like, as he's making references to people from his past. And this up and down mood was absolutely frightening to witness, even more so when you consider it was on live television and radio, a very unpredictable situation, and a man very unpredictable at that point with lethality. And I don't know that we would do that again. Although, John, as well as anybody, the rules of journalism are certainly changing as we move towards, sort of the new media universe that we have. So maybe it would get on television. I think there's a point at which, though, most of us would probably say, I don't know that we need to be in that kind of a moment live. We want to monitor it. We want to be close to it. But do we give this raging man with a gun to the back of the head of another man access to live television? That line we have continued to debate since that day in February back in Indianapolis.
Well, and there was one anchor, if I recall correctly, here in Indy, who, one station who refused to air it. I mean, it was intense debate, a subject of intense debate even at that time. That was only one of the impacts, though, of the Caritas episode. It also had a large role in changing the way people are sentenced, too, here in Indiana.
Yes.
Yeah. I'll throw that to either Alan or Mark.
Yeah, like I'd mentioned earlier, there was the burden of proof on how to prove somebody was not guilty by reason of insanity. And it's not just because of the Caritas case. There were a couple others that also impacted it. But Caritas was the main case here in Indianapolis where they had to change it so that the defense, if they wanted to go for that reason by insanity plea, they had to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that their client was insane. And that made it much harder After that, you don't see many successful insanity defense pleas. It also changed the way police handle things.
Mm-hmm.
Like Tom was saying, he may not have had the choice of covering it. The police now would never let it go public like this. They would have closed it down. He never would have got out of the Meridian Mortgage building. I mean, there were so many firsts here that then become – that cement the way police and media dealt with things later.
And in today's world, if there is a public – if public can be in this arena of something happening, you can't control what the public are going to film. And with Periscope and other live streaming apps, you're not going to be able to control it. So I think that the police would be the biggest factor in today's world if something gets to be aired or not.
So let me ask. I'm going to ask this of Alan and Mark. How do you tell this story without having your film consume 63 hours? What kind of arc are you going to try to do here?
So the story, first of all, it's a lot of editing. It's a lot of going through footage and just finding the stuff that makes sense, that makes the story. One of our biggest concerns throughout this whole process is to make sure that it's accurate. We want to make sure that what we're telling is a true story. But we also want to make it entertaining. So we're trying to combine those two. But the arc is kind of – do you want to kind of talk about the
– Well, we primarily cover the three-day event.
Mm-hmm.
And we have way more than 63 hours of stuff. You cannot imagine. So that's the main part of it because it's just so frightening. And there will be a bit with the trial and some of the aftermath. But the really exciting part is how do these two guys navigate this three-day event when you've got police around, there's SWAT, there's all these places where something could happen. How did they survive this? How did no one get injured? That to me ends up, I mean, that's the incredible part. I mean, people who've not seen it before will be like, oh, is somebody going to get killed? That's not how this climaxes.
Real quickly, we got about 10 seconds left. The title is Dead Man's Line. When is it going to be done and when will people be able to see it?
So we're editing it right now. Our hopes is to enter it into Heartland and that it gets accepted to Heartland. And then if that's the case, it'll be premiered there in, I think, October when Heartland films.
Well, I'd like to thank my guests, Alan Berry, Mark Enox, Tom Cochran, and Jack Parker for what has been a fascinating, if slightly disturbing, trip down memory lane here, reliving the Tony Kuritzis episode. I'd like to invite all of our listeners to come back on Thursday when we're going to be talking about mass transit in anticipation of the big city-county council vote. I'm John Kroll. You've been listening to No Limits. Thank you for joining us.
No Limits is a production of 90.1 WFYI Public Radio, Indianapolis. Executive Producer, Michelle Johnson. Producer, Shannon Cagle. Interactive Media Coordinator, Scott McAllister. Technical Producers, Cedric Freeman and Chris Flood. And Board Engineer, Joe Hatcher. Abby Cherzini screens our calls. No Limits is made available through IPBS, Indiana's public broadcasting stations.